ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If you woke up tomorrow and found yourself Prime Minister, what would you do? How would you run Australia? What's your plan for energy, for housing, for the economy? The Economy Stupid has a three-part series talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it where you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
Hello, this is David Rutledge. Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone and the first program in our Radio National summer season of highlights from 2025. I'm quite excited about this week's show because it's one of those episodes that pull a number of ideas and phenomena from different points in time and space and then put them together in really interesting ways. Our main reference point is the stolen generations and the continuing practice in Australia of removing First Nations children from their homes and families. But along the way, we're also bringing in the notion of childhood innocence, the history of 19th century Britain and the rise of the middle class there, the advent of photography, and if that wasn't enough, we're also going to be talking about mid-20th century decorative Australian tableware. Stay with me. My guest is Joanne Faulkner, who's senior lecturer in the School of Communication, Society and Culture at Macquarie University in Sydney. She's been working for many years now on the ethics of innocence, particularly the constellation of ideas around childhood innocence. But more recently, she's been looking at the modern conceptualization of childhood in relation to colonization in Australia. Joanne, earlier this year, gave a paper at the University of Sydney on parallels between the removal of First Nations children from their families and the so-called child rescue movement in 19th century Britain, where children living in poverty were taken from their families, sometimes abducted, and put into charitable institutions where the idea was to turn them into model citizens. There's a lot to talk about there, so we'll get right into it. The child rescue movement in 19th century Britain was a response to the visible presence of children living in poverty on the streets of London and other cities. What exactly did these children represent to the middle class at the time? What anxieties did they provoke or reflect?
Yes, so this is a time of the rise of the middle class. There had been all sorts of changes, social changes connected with industrialization as well as colonization that were taking place in England, which meant overpopulation of cities, greater urbanization after the Enclosure Acts had pushed families out of the country into the city. And there was a lot of poverty. There was a huge gap in law to deal with the rise in poverty and overcrowding and the social issues that were emerging from that, including, factories that basically had no regulation around how overworked the factory workers were and children who were also employed as factory workers. And this was affecting their health, their growth. So there were some genuine problems that a middle class were beginning to see. But there's also, I guess, a cultural context in which the ragged child, as they were called, emerged in that context. And that is through the kind of romanticization of childhood as a new form of human life, as a kind of stage of life that was seen as precious, as innocent, as kind of more enchanted than adulthood. So seeing children in the street who were, perhaps looked dirtier than their own children, who were not well-fed or well-shod, and who didn't really have an opportunity to perform childhood innocence in the way that more wealthy children were. This presented a real challenge to the middle-class understanding of social progress and the place that they saw for themselves in society as improvers of society and also as moderators of the ills of society, of its excesses. So the middle class positioned themselves as being able to campaign for the moderation of basically capitalism and its effects on the working class. And children were both an attractive site for that attention because they were children and because there was some notion of them having an innocence to salvage. They were future citizens, so taking them for the child rescuers, taking them and giving them an education and cleaning them up and training them was part of making them better citizens and also reducing the risk of them becoming criminalised. And there was this juxtaposition between the idea of the innocent child and these children who really didn't look innocent, couldn't perform innocence, also led to a kind of demonisation of them. They were kind of like folk devils, these children who were not children, who were actually had none of the innocence or the kind of goods that children represent, and instead they were pickpockets and they were foul-mouthed and they were no different from their parents in the eyes of the newspapers of the time, for instance. So because of that volatility around their meaning, they were really a site for anxiety, for the concentration of anxiety, and also for remedy of social ills. That's kind of what made them really perfect at that time as a commodity that could be changed and thus benefit the world in all sorts of ways.
I'm interested in some of the language that was used at the time to refer to these children, in particular the term street Arab, which is not a phrase I'd come across before. What sort of connotations lie behind that term?
It's pretty barefaced in its racist connotations. At the time, there was, processes of colonisation taking place in the Middle East. So, yeah, there's this kind of, I guess, distancing of those children from white children through that use of, like, it's kind of saying they're no better than, is the implication, than racialised people in the Middle East. So, yeah, street Arabs was a kind of harder way of referring to ragged children. Yeah, but it's a way of separating them entirely from a colonial whiteness or, the whiteness that was championed by empire through colonial expeditions. There's a lot packed in there.
yeah. So along comes Thomas John Barnardo, Dr. Barnardo. I can remember hearing all about Dr. Barnardo when I was in primary school, and he was sort of lionized as this sort of great man of history. Your work paints him in a very different light. So Christian philanthropist, former missionary, founder and director of Homes for Poor and Deprived Children. The first Barnardo's home appears in London in 1867. He pitched his charitable institutions in a very interesting way using particular kinds of imagery. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. So, Dr. Barnardo wasn't a doctor, a former missionary, but he used photography, which was a new technology at the time, and it had all sorts of cachet as being able to produce realistic representations and representations that or images that told the truth about a particular time, like a particular moment and place. So he used photography to stage these before and after photographs to show his work to a public and thus garner donations so that he can keep doing his work. So the before photographs were characteristically showed a child in ragged clothes with a miserable expression on their face and very much characterised a particular stereotype about the poor, ragged child. The after photograph, which was after they had been trained or had been in one of his homes for destitute lads, for instance, showed him in neat and clean clothing and looking like he's ready to, and it's usually, well, pretty much always boys, looking like he's ready to go out into the world and, you know, fight for empire or take up a trade. So the images themselves, it's like this visual narrative of transformation that takes the ragged child off the street and brings them into society to do good and productive work along with the rest of society. So cleans them up out of this excess population that is, you know, universally derided.
Yeah, it's also worth mentioning that just in passing that he actually abducted children from London slums for his purposes, right, or had them abducted.
Yes, that's right. And, yes, I've relied on the work of Seth Coven for these insights. Yes, he more or less like a dog catcher took children from the streets who looked to him to be ragged, who would be good material for transformation and perhaps also for to photograph. But yes, there was a kind of, I guess, middle class bourgeois feeling of superiority that you can take a child from their context, that that is going to improve their life, and that what they are being taken from is nothing, is worthless and absolutely irredeemable. And so, of course, it's a fine thing to take them without asking.
Let's turn to Australia now, and we'll come back to Dr. Bernardo in a minute. But in Australia, we have the familiar figure of the piccaninny, the cute and chubby caricature of an Aboriginal child whose image could be found decorating white Australian households across the nation in the early to mid-20th century. How is the piccaninny child in Australian iconography typically represented? What does this child look like?
I've relied on the work of distinguished Professor Aileen Morton Robinson, who's a really leading Aboriginal thinker in Australia, and also historian Liz Connor have written about this particular figure of the piccaninny, or the Aboriginal child as piccaninny. So it's a term that has come from colonial culture more globally. But in Australia, the way that it emerges is this very cutesy, kind of plump, pinchable, cute Aboriginal child, like the ragged child, barely clothed, often with an animal. So they look like they're part of nature. They're never with their own people. They're never with parents. So they're very much styled as waif-like in the way that ragged children had been in British culture, which is, we know that settler culture is a kind of transposed British culture. So it kind of frames those children similarly as in need of rescue and as not really connected to family or community or to a culture, a way of life, but as ready to be rescued and transformed. And those, like the plates of ceramicware of Brownie Downing are one example. Probably if you went through your grandparents' belongings, there'd be something there. But this image is preserved in contemporary renderings of Aboriginal childhood, and we saw this very much in Baz Luhrmann's film Australia, this epic film that was about the Australia, the kind of becoming nation of Australia, and takes the stolen generations as a core subplot. But the child, Nulla, is very much styled in the piccaninny kind of styling. So there are very problematic meanings that cohere around that character and that grasp at a ready identification that white settlers have as child rescuers. So, yes, it's a kind of rendering of the Aboriginal child that softens the coloniser from taking land in a violent fashion to rescuing children.
I want to go back to one aspect of this piccaninny iconography you mentioned, and that's that the child is always represented as being separate from adults and separate from any sort of representation of their culture. What's the significance of that separation? Because it serves a particular colonial interest, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's in the context of already this romanticisation of childhood and separation of the child as a focus or a subject of art. But in the colonial context, and when it's an Aboriginal child, it very much is showing the child as not embedded in a culture or a society with other children, other adults, and not in relationships of care with people of their culture. So very much like the figure of the waif, which is homeless and without parentage, are the connotations of that word. It separates them and loosens them from those social binds that would give them security and would represent them as having a people and a culture that they're already embedded in and that gives them safety. So representing those children out of that context really does render them as available as aesthetic objects and as children who need to be rescued, which often meant trained to be house workers or farmhands. So it gives a kind of nice story to what is actually a colonial imposition of power.
You cite the work of the US political theorist Toby Rollo, who has written about the colonial characterization of Indigenous people more generally, and how they're depicted in ways that undermine things like what we see in Australia, for example, as sovereign claim to the land. So in the Pickaninny motif, we see a representation of Indigenous people that actually reinforces the concept of terra nullius, which I think is really interesting. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, so Toby Rollo also works on the cultural politics of childhood in a settler colonial context and has written about this, I guess, convergence of representations of the child and the native, which is often infantilized. So the term he uses is filius nullius, so the Indigenous person is represented as being orphaned, as having no inheritance, no lineage, no history. And this means it's very easy if you are a colonizer who comes to a country and sees all these people, but to see them not as having a right to the land they're on, not as having any claim to it even, because they're in some strange ahistorical and, you know, fantasy space of like a Neverland. Nothing changes, there's no responsibility, they're just living off the land in a kind of wasteful way without any kind of historical development. Well, that narrative is really supported by this representation of Indigenous peoples generally as like children.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, this is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and my guest this week is Joanne Faulkner from Macquarie University in Sydney. Tell me more about this work that Aileen Morton Robinson has been doing on the Pickaninny image in Australian homeware and sort of kitschy Australian art. I can remember seeing a lot of that kind of thing when I was growing up in the 1960s and 70s, and these ornamental dishes and bowls and other ceramics. What does Aileen Morton Robinson write about these in terms of the aesthetic elaboration of a kind of colonial logic here? What is she saying about that?
Yes, an aesthetic elaboration or kind of element that supports a colonial possessive logic. And I guess notably these objects that were seen as desirable and that people decorated their home with you know, pictures of cute Aboriginal children, you know, frolicking with platypuses or other animals. There are homemaker's object, you kind of domesticate your surroundings using these kinds of images, and it's a way of claiming ownership of those children and imagining yourself as a rescuer of those children. So the aesthetic dimension is about how we see the world, how we make sense of things that are happening in the world and our part in it. So to have an aesthetic within the home that celebrates this particular way of imagining the Aboriginal child goes hand in hand with actual policies and deeds that took Aboriginal children from their communities.
I guess you could argue, though, that the link here is tenuous, or at least more correlative than causative, because on one hand we have the exercise of hard government power through the forced removal of Aboriginal children from their families. On the other hand, we have homewares, decorative plates. But you see a very strong link here. You write that this concordance of the political and the aesthetic is not accidental. I think that's really interesting. What are you getting at here?
I guess I'm not looking at a causative relationship as much as they interact with each other and support each other. So if you think about the domestic realm in the 1950s, where we have this Aboriginal kitsch. But before that, and, you know, alongside it, the domestic sphere is also a colonial frontier. So children who were taken from their families, put into training institutions, would then go into people's homes and look after their children and do the kind of domestic work that perhaps white workers wouldn't do or were paid too much to do. So it's not so much a cleavage between the domestic sphere and home furnishings and the kind of, I guess, externalised brutal face of colonialism and the removal of children. The domestic sphere was much more implicated in even those actions than we like to think. So even in those homes, though, where there wasn't a presence of Aboriginal child workers, there was still an understanding of the benevolent presence of the white coloniser and what needed to be done about the Aboriginal problem, and a normalisation of the idea of taking children and training them for their own good, that those aestheticisations of that ideology was really integral to.
On this issue of representation, let's go back to the Bernardo's homes in London in the 19th century for a minute. And the way that Thomas Bernardo staged his before and after photos of street children, because these were essentially fakes and they were unmasked as such. And what's really interesting is that this fakery scandal, while it was a scandal, mostly among his commercial competitors, it didn't really dent his reputation or his business enterprise that badly. And you've written that Bernardo's deception had shaken confidence in his representations in these photos, but had also conjured something iconic, conveying a truth, quote unquote, a truth beyond the reality of the particular child depicted. What was that notional truth?
Yeah, so it's the truth that people like to cling to, even if the things that they see conflict with it. So there's a broader understanding of truth that fits more in a narrative of how the world works and how we fit within it. Yes, so he was forcibly taking children. He was staging the before photograph by ripping their clothes more, dirtying them up, you know, smearing dirt on their faces and making them look, you know, uncared for in a way that was not necessarily truthful. And, you know, it has been shown that, you know, there's historical literature that talks about the care that working class parents did show their children precisely because they didn't want them to be stigmatised, to be stereotyped as ragged and possibly to also be removed from them. So there was this kind of, I guess, stretching of truth that created a new truth, which is that this child is in need of rescue. And while his competitors in the field of philanthropy were very exercised over the deception that he engaged in, it wasn't for the reason that necessarily that he was taking children against their will, but because he was using a technology that they had faith in, that was truthful, that had an epistemological kind of value, and he was using that to tell a lie. But this kind of all comes out of the wash a little bit, so to speak, because it still fits within the broader narrative or ideology that they're working with themselves, that these children are in need of rescue, and on a grand scale, working children on the streets need to be taken and trained into productive members of society. So I guess the word truthiness and the crisis in truth that we're going through presently in our political culture. But yes, it tells people what they want to hear because it so clearly articulates an idea about middle class virtue. Then it becomes raised in esteem to a kind of truth that otherwise it would just be a dirty lie.
Yeah. What I think is really interesting here is that this 19th century model of child rescue, where the child is this kind of raw material taken to be trained into the useful citizen, incorporated into useful society, that this draws from the same well as the proponents of eugenics were drawing from in early 20th century Australia. People like A.O. Neville, the chief protector of Aborigines and commissioner of native affairs in Western Australia. Very interesting. What's the connection there?
Yeah, so I guess I refer to eugenics there or eugenic thinking in a couple of ways. The first being that there was a concern among the middle class and among progressive citizens, you know, across the English-speaking world and elsewhere, that the worst kind of people were breeding the fastest. So if only middle-class women, educated women, would have lots of children, but instead they're, you know, becoming professionals and the bulk of the children are being birthed by people who are seen as lesser than and a different type of person, a lower type of person. I mean, that's very much part of the framework in which the ragged child emerges as this excessive population, and what are we going to do about the growth of this population that the child represents that growth. In Australia, there is definitely that anxiety. Neville, in his book, Australia's Coloured Minority, Its Place in Our Community, he explicitly characterises what he calls half-caste children, children who have both Aboriginal and European lineage, that these children are the fastest growing demographic, and that for him is enough to sound an alarm. And it plays very much into the same narrative overseas that the wrong kind of people are proliferating. And he really does make some pretty offensive, extremely offensive remarks about the kind of people, what he calls half-castes or half-bloods, that their character is different from that of the full-blood Aboriginal and that of white people. And his eugenic remedy for this is to bring in legislation or to adhere to legislation that means that protectors can control who marries whom for the end of breeding out the colour. So there's this what would be called controlled miscegenation, that after a few generations, he says three generations, you will have children who may as well be white as far as he's concerned, or at least will pass as white. And he saw Aboriginality as basically, you know, in the skin of a person. So once someone looks white, they're no longer Aboriginal. And of course, we know that Aboriginality is determined by all sorts of other things like relationships to your family, your culture and communities, and it's not about the colour of people's skin. So his object was to breed out the colour so that Aboriginal people could enter the white Australia without residue at the bottom of, you know, the food chain as labourers and house workers.
Well, we've gone down a very dark road here. We've found ourselves talking about eugenics, and it's interesting how something as seemingly innocuous as decorative tableware can take us there. How about if we bring things back to the present day? The proponents of eugenics haven't, I guess, disappeared. They've more retreated to the grubbier corners of the internet. The decorative pickaninny plates, they can still be found occasionally in vintage and antique shops, but there can't be too many people still proudly displaying them on their walls at home. How do these things play into current thinking around Indigenous children? Have we come a long way in terms of social attitudes?
What we see of that kind of eugenic thinking in current Australian culture, well, we see it in news media, particularly in the, I guess, the opinion kind of side of news media, where there's commentary about whether or not someone is Aboriginal because they have light skin, and also that demonises particular communities, that characterises them as lawless and in need of, you know, suppression or the intervention of state force, police. You know, that discourse is very present in the way that Australians talk about the place of Aboriginal people, and it's quite eugenic in its formation, focusing on skin colour, which is, you know, entirely a colonial way of measuring Aboriginality, but also drawing again on those infantilising images of Indigenous people or characterisations of Indigenous people that Toby Rollo talks about. So infantilising them, saying that they can't take care of their own children, and this again is a rationale for removing Aboriginal children at a greater rate than any other group.
What about the perception of Aboriginal children? Are we still haunted by the figure of the pickaninny there?
I think certainly. If you just look at images, stock images that are used when reporting about Aboriginal communities is in the news, we often see exactly those kinds of pickaninny waif-like photographs of Aboriginal children that then inform the way that we read the content of the news article. I think the pickaninny is still pretty much everywhere, and it's a way of, I guess, for most people who are processing that image, they're not thinking that that is a kind of dangerous child or a child that needs correction necessarily, or even anything, you know, consciously about their parents or community, but it works at the level of the unconscious, at the kind of unthought background through which meaning takes shape for us. So it's there as something we're not really even aware that we think about Aboriginal children, but that we encounter and interact with and take part in every time we are consuming or sharing those kinds of images. So, it's very much in a place that we don't think about. And I think that's why we don't see the progress that we're supposed to be seeing with the introduction of new legislation and policies around the removal of Aboriginal children, because the ways of seeing that so much shape the decisions that are made and the presentiments we have about these children and families are in a place that we don't really subject to scrutiny or criticism. They're just operating in a habitual way to shape our decisions.
And of course, this all plays into the execution of government policy, the assumptions about Indigenous people that inform the way that bureaucrats in departments of Indigenous affairs approach their jobs, right?
I think certainly. In 2019, Professor Megan Davis, she published a review where she looked at all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children cases that had been in the FACTS system, Family and Community Services, over a period of a year. And she really pulled out a lot of the practices and the prejudices, the things that people had said and heard, in a way that really is quite illuminating. One thing that she points to as a driving force of the failure for there to be improvement in this area is what she calls ritualism. And this is the habits that bureaucrats get into to achieve short-term goals in a department that is driven on the everyday level by risk-averse kind of practices. She says that in a work environment like FACTS, the kind of regulatory and legal framework and policy hasn't been until recently geared towards paying attention to what happens to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. And so there's been a kind of ritualised habit that people working in that place are really ingrained, such that their assessments and risk assessments are very driven by the goal to avoid risk rather than the goals that are set by legislation and policy. And that place of risk aversion is open season for any kind of extra legal kind of understanding of the child's risk. And that's where all of those kinds of cultural representations and narratives about Aboriginal children are brought to bear.
Joanne Faulkner, she's senior lecturer in the School of Communication, Society and Culture at Macquarie University in Sydney. Joanne does extremely interesting work, and you can find links to it on the Philosopher's Zone website, where you can also stream all of our past episodes. And of course, you can also find us on ABC Listen. This episode was produced on Bundjalung land by me, David Rutledge, and it's been the first in our Radio National summer season of highlight programs from 2025. Pleasure to have your company this week, and I'll see you next time.